7. Joining the BBC. I'm standing in front of a building that is literally steeped in history. Behind me is London's swanky Regent Street, home to the Café Royal, Hamley's Toy Store, and a genuinely impressive two-storey McDonald's. Ahead of me, as I say, is a formidable structure, headquarters to broadcasting magnificence. Inside its brownie-coloured walls are rooms, studios and cupboards that have played host to some of the greatest moments in broadcasting. Just a minute, Gardner's Question Time, John Burt's 55th birthday party. I'm about to start work for an organisation that needs absolutely no introduction, qualification or explanation. Listener, I'm about to work for Radio 4, the BBC One of UK radio. Before this big break, I'd been to London before, once for Carol's birthday when she was going through an unfulfilled phase and had ideas above her/Norwich station, and another time when I had to pick up a cagoule that had found its way onto the Charlton Athletic team bus after a fractious post-match interview. But working in the capital, that was quite unexpected. I'd received the good news during an intervention. Carol's brother Tim was drinking too much, so it effectively ambushed him in our lounge, and I was pleased that my own success could, in a small way, deflect attention from his enormous failings. To provide a bit of levity, I left the room for a moment and came back in wearing a bowler hat and an umbrella, saying, "I'm going to work in London," while marching up and down. I thought it was absolutely hilarious. After a stern word from Carol, the intervention continued in earnest, and I'm delighted to say it was a success. Tim's barely touched a drop since then, apart from wine. Although it was Sunday, I thought it best that I telephoned every one of my Radio Norwich colleagues to tell them I'd been plucked for national stardom and I'd be leaving Norwich. It was best they found out from me, as I knew that the loss of the radio station's Mr. Sport would hit them hard. Most of them took it well and showed tremendous stoicism, displaying almost no emotion. I began to make arrangements for my new life, but it was only after I completely cleared my desk weeks later that I found out that On the Hour was to be a weekly show, which meant that we were only required in London on Friday. I spoke to the station controller of Radio Norwich, quickly unresigned, and set about returning the items to my desk. There were a few snide remarks from colleagues, but I was unperturbed, glad even that I'd made the error, as the process of clearing and then restocking my workspace was an absolute pleasure. It allowed me to conduct a full stationary audit, think seriously about the strategy and ergonomics of my desk and devise a new layout that was fresher, simpler, and more logical. The telephone was switched to the far left on the grounds that I tended to wedge the receiver under my left jowl and use my right hand to scribble notes or gesticulate. To that end, my pen, jar, and notepad were migrated from the leftmost reaches of the space to a new position just by the right hand. The computer monitor, previously slap-bang in the middle, was perched in the right-hand corner, angled jauntily in my face's favour. Snacks and chocks were housed in a new Tupperware box in the top drawer, a radical departure which freed up a good quartile of the desk's surface. Staplers, hole punches, sticky-backed plastic, post-it notes, gone in a hard-headed cull of underused items. The angle poise was placed, nice touch this, on an adjoining cabinet, not impinging on the desktop at all, and casting its fine beam from an unusual angle, which gave a quality of light that was genuinely different from that of the desks of Elaine Clark, News, or Sophie DeVault, Weather. It was a pared-down and original layout that was user-friendly and looked good too. I've tried several other designs since, but have honestly never bettered this one. If I have the time, I'll sketch it out and put it in the appendix, entirely free of charge. It all felt like a fresh start for me. A new city, a new job, a new desk system, even a new brother-in-law who could speak clearly and wasn't over-affectionate with my kids. I was cock-a-hoop. Radio 4's On the Hour was a weekly news programme with seriously big balls. It made Newsnight look like News Round, and the 9 o'clock news look like News Round. If other shows were a normal-sized packet of crisps, On the Hour was very much a grab bag. And for those of you unfamiliar with the denominations of crisp bags, that means it was large. It was a serious break for me, and I knew it. I'll never forget my first week on the job. On the morning of the show, I'd arrived with nothing other than a Schlesinger backpack, a selection of snacks and sandwiches, a spare shirt and tie, a notebook, pens, pencils, pencil sharpener, first aid kit, an emergency 50 pence piece for the phone box, and, I hoped, a glint in my eye. I hopped on the tube and made my way over to the BBC. By the way, anyone reading this overseas or in Wales, the tube is a means of public transport. The show was to be recorded in the august surroundings of Broadcasting House. What a building. As soon as you walked through the doors, you could tell these people knew what they were doing. Quite simply, the place stank of news. But this reek of pure BBC quality only added to my sense of apprehension. With only an hour to go until the opening editorial meeting, nerves fluttered around my stomach. It's a hard feeling to describe, but it was almost as if someone had put moths in my tummy. It was of some comfort to me that I knew one of the team already. On the Hour was edited by the redoubtable, love that word, Stephen Eastwood. I'd met him when I came up to London for my job interview. Things had begun, as they so often do at the BBC, with a handshake. "That's a good handshake you've got there, Alan." "Thanks," I replied. "I practice it in front of the mirror." "And how was your journey?" "Really good, thanks, Stephen," I said, briefly forgetting that his name was actually spelt with a V and not a PH. "So tell me, young man, how much do you want this job?" he probed. "What's it out of? 10? But Eastwood didn't want a number. If he had, my answer would have been 10, maybe 11. He just wanted to see a flicker of true passion. Thankfully for me, that's exactly what he saw. And incredibly, that was all it took, along with a 90-minute interview, a written exam, a series of psychometric tests, and a submission of a full portfolio of my work for him to offer me the job. Well, from that moment onwards, our relationship went from strength to strength to strength to strength to strength. On a personal level, things were slightly different. He and I were just chalk and cheddar. At the height of the show's popularity, I was receiving 5, sometimes 6 pieces of fan mail per quarter. It was pretty relentless, and if I'm honest, I think it stuck in Eastwood's craw. Sure, I tried to build bridges from time to time. I'd take him to the BBC bar and order us each a pint of bitter and a meat-based sandwich. But he'd take a few sips before claiming he was dead drunk and needed to go home. Maybe it was possible to get drunk that quickly. I've certainly heard it that Chinamen can't hold their booze. But all these years later, when I think back to those aborted evenings out, there was just one tiny detail that doesn't add up. Eastwood wasn't Chinese. Okay, he had a soft spot for a portion of chicken chow mein on a Friday night, but to be honest, who doesn't? And besides, even the most berserk sinophile would struggle to argue that ingesting industrial amounts of egg noodles actually makes you Chinese. No, Eastwood was from Hertfordshire, and there was nothing anybody could do about it. But as I made my way to the first editorial meeting, I knew I had my fellow reporters to wow. Questions tumbled around my head like trainers in a washing machine I've mentioned on 2 previous occasions. Would I pass muster? Would I cut the mustard? Would I pass the mustard? I was panicking. There was no point spending my time conflating 2 well-known phrases or sayings into a third that, while making grammatical sense, had no value as a metaphor. Or was there? I thought for a moment. No, there definitely wasn't. Somehow I needed to chill the F out. In the end, I sorted myself up by using a simple but effective visualization technique taught to me by either Paul McKenna or Russ Abbott, I forget which. Ali Bongo, taken from the teachings of Buddha, I'm guessing here. The idea is to imagine yourself as someone with the characteristic you desire. In the case of Bongo, he would think of a cuddly old cat lying in the sunshine. Before a show, he would spend 15 minutes purring, licking his imaginary paws, and hanging his head over a bin trying to bring up fur balls. And by the end of it, he was cool as beans. For me, though, cats weren't the answer. No, the answer was Roger Moore. I locked myself in a toilet cubicle and spent the best part of a quarter of an hour visualizing myself in A View to a Kill, taking on the evil Max Zorin, sailing under the ocean in a submarine disguised as an iceberg, and having it off with Grace Jones, the first black woman I have ever slept with. And by the time someone started banging on the door, wondering what all the noise was about, I had reached a zen-like state of calm. As it turns out, though, I was right to be anxious about the editorial meeting. There were some seriously large-brained people in the room. Those in attendance included Christopher Morris, anchor, Rosie May, environment, Kevin Smear, roving reporter, Peter O'Hanrahan, economics editor, and yours truly, sport plus the Paralympics. I picked a chair and sat down quietly and effectively. It was a good start, but I needed to do more. I took a deep breath and prepared to introduce myself. But as soon as I heard the level of their chit-chat, I froze. They were using words, ideas, and concepts that you simply never heard in Norfolk, not even in Norwich. I resolved to keep my mouth shut until I'd acclimatized/acclimated. Phrases swirled around the room. Where does Labour stand on that? It's over for Milosevic. Alan, could you pass the biscuits? The Rodney King thing is going to be massive. GDP's down by 0.5% this quarter. Alan, the biscuits. The Home Office aren't going to comment, apparently. Fine, I'll get them myself, then. How in the name of holy living heck was I going to bust my way into this conversation? I don't know, I answered inside my head. On the table next to me was a tea urn. Now this was a plus point because I love tea urns. Still do. There's something very reassuring about the concept of hot beverages dispensed from a lovely big drum. Of course, your problem with any kind of communal drink station is the sugar bowl. People put the spoon back in the bowl after stirring in their sugar. No problem with that, you might think. Well, think again. The residual moisture acts as a caking agent, forming the granules into unsightly asymmetric clumps. Worse still, those clumps are stained a grubby brown by the tannin-rich tea. Not nice. Not nice at all. And let's not forget the germ issue. Putting a damp spoon back in the bowl is the tea-drinking equivalent of sharing a needle, and I did not want to end up with their tea-drinking equivalent of AIDS. Instantly it struck me that if their thing was intimidating intellect, my thing could be beverage-related hygiene. Of course, later I remembered that I already had a thing, namely sport plus Paralympics, but I wasn't thinking straight, which should go some way to explaining what happened next. Kevin Smear, roving reporter, approached. This seemed somehow appropriate because while the others had stayed where they were, he had literally roved over. Hello, Alan. Hello. Guys, I'm just saying hello to Alan. The rest of them nodded in my direction using their heads. What are you doing over there? Said Rosie May, environment. Nothing much, I smiled. Just thinking that you lot have probably got tea AIDS. Wham! I knew it was a winner as soon as it left my lips. If you'd stuck me in a room with a typewriter for 10 years, I would never have come up with one that good. But in that room, fueled by nothing other than raw nerves, out it plopped, fully formed and ready to go. Of course, it wasn't a winner at all. Not being privy to my train of thought, they had no idea what the T prefix was. As far as they were concerned, their new colleague had just accused them all of having AIDS. Yet they didn't have AIDS, and though the colourful lifestyle of one of them certainly put him in the at-risk category, he wouldn't go fully blown till 2003. No, I was wrong to suggest that they all suffered from a terminal beverage-based illness, whether it was tea AIDS, coffee cancer, or hot chocolate tumours. I was so ashamed by my behaviour that I retreated into my shell like a turtle would if it realised it was about to have a car reverse over its head. And it was in my shell that I would stay for most of my time on the Hour. To be honest, you'd find this unfriendly attitude across the whole of BBC News and Current Affairs team. It saddened me because the department was populated by heroes of mine. Faces I'd watched time and again on the news whilst eating my dinner. Pork chops and gravy, beans on toast, hot pot, chicken pie and chips, maybe even coq au vin, sometimes just a quick can of soup. Any meal, really, it doesn't matter. I just realised I'm listing things I have for dinner when I should be listing faces I've seen on the news, but I'm just saying that I'd seen these people on the news and I'd respected them. But their reassuring televisual demeanour was, I realised, a facade. In person, they didn't like to mingle at all, not even with each other. Many was the time I'd see Nicholas Witchell sitting all alone in the canteen. It was a shame because years later, I realised we both shared a love of collecting butterflies. He has an enormous collection in his London flat. I like to imagine that after a hard day following the Royals, he returns home, sits in an armchair with a mug of cocoa, and waits as his entire herd of butterflies greets him by flitter-fluttering their way over and landing on his naked body. But I know for a fact that this can't happen because his entire collection is dead, each one attached to a display case with a single pin through its heart.